Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center and have with me today on the program, Shireen Gorbani on the left. Hi, Shireen.
Hello, and hi to the listeners.
And Senator Dan McKay on the right. Hi, Dan.
Hey, everybody. Good to join you. Fresh off the Hill, and I got to be honest, it is good to be adjourned for the legislature for the day. So
I believe you.
It was a special session week. Shireen, I was in the Capitol yesterday walking through the rotunda, and I can see Dan off in the distance, and I'm kind of creeping up to him because I wanted to share something with him. He never looked at me, but when I walked up, he said without looking, "Well, here comes Natalie Gochner." And I don't know how he could see me, but Dan, you're a clever guy up on the Hill.
Well, thank you. That's, I will say this. It is difficult being, somewhat humorous and trying to keep, committee hearings lively and attentive and all those other things and serious, with the nature. But I constantly have to just kind of keep an eye on myself and make sure I don't get too far ahead of myself. Because politicians are never as funny as we think that we are. I mean, the people around us constantly, they're laughing at our jokes, but I really wonder if we're that funny.
No, they feel like they have to laugh.
Yeah.
Well,
Natalie's got a courtesy laugh there. That was delightful, but it was a perfect example of what I hear on a regular basis.
You were engaged in serious work this week on the Hill with a special session, and a lot of interesting things. We'll cover a bunch of them, but let's start with the $1.6 billion in federal coronavirus stimulus relief money that has come to our state. This is in addition to a lot of other, in the billions of dollars that have come. But you all took the task of appropriating, I think, about $540 million of it. Let's just walk through it one by one, get both of you to comment. One of the first things you did, one of the biggest expenditures, $100 million to put back into the state's unemployment fund. Shireen, this is the, if I've got this right, this is the trust fund, Dan, right? This is the money that's been being paid out, and we're replenishing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the absence of, if we didn't put money into that fund, we would see major increases on employers because everybody's lost employees here and there. And that trust fund really, it's meant to cover unemployment claims and those kinds of things, during times of normal, but it's not meant to handle when, you have massive unemployment spikes like we did for the beginning of the coronavirus.
Shireen, is this a good use of the money?
I do think this is a good move. Yeah, I think it's a good just overall stabilizing decision and something that ultimately ensures that this resource will continue to be there for people who need it.
I will say that I would not call this stimulative because stimulative is stuff that you're spending right now that goes into the economy and, creates activity. And this is for future spending. But Dan, you supported this, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And for obviously for a lot of reasons, but one, our goal is to try and get the economy back on track. And if we straddle employers and ultimately employees, with a major liability for massive unemployment insurance premiums, that's really going to put a damper on the creation of jobs and bringing people back into the workforce.
Dan, they took $50 million and put it towards grants for local businesses impacted by the pandemic. When I say they, I should say you. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So, it's not just local businesses. There's also, money in there or, stipulations in there for local government. And that fund really is going to be an opportunity, to kind of bring and help bring these small businesses. And Shireen has been, very effective advocate on this issue, but just talking about how we have so many small businesses, restaurants, and others within the service industry that have suffered and, trying to reach out in a targeted way to, to help solve some of those gaps. I think that'll be meaningful.
Yeah. Shireen, I bet you like this one, particularly you love the performing arts and the arts groups. And I think those are some of the businesses that would qualify for this.
I do. And I also have, I appreciate Dan saying that. I've been a real advocate for our small local businesses. We have seen that they are the heart of many communities and to see so many on the ropes throughout this last year. And it is exciting to see them coming back, but many are still in a pretty precarious financial situation. So I think this is a great investment, and especially those art spaces, our performing arts spaces, to know that those will continue to be there on the other side of this is wonderful as a person who's, always advocating for the arts in our lives.
Yeah.
You know, if I showed you guys the unanswered text messages from Shireen with what are you doing for these small businesses? I mean, the sheer volume of them will just let you know when I say that she's an advocate. It borders on really annoying neighbor, but at the same time, it's so welcome and she's in the right place.
We talk about using some of this stimulus money to create a legacy impact on our state. I'm very excited about the $90 million that will help establish a mental health institute at the University of Utah. I'd love to just share with listeners a couple of statistics. We have over 100,000 adults in Utah experiencing serious mental illness. 60% of Utah's depressed youth aged 12 to 17 did not receive treatment for depression. Suicide, leading cause of death for Utahns aged 10 to 24. So Dan and Shireen, this is money well spent.
This is money well spent, absolutely. And when I know I've talked about this multiple times, but in opportunities, especially campaigning statewide, or well, not statewide, but over a large chunk of the state, it's really incredible to reflect on just, I have not met a Utahn who's not personally touched by these issues, either themselves or directly with their family, to think about really expanding the mental health resources. Access to help and support for families across the state is, and I genuinely mean this, life-saving.
And there's going to be some, you know, private donors who will step in and, you know, help, you know, obviously the Huntsman name is going to be associated with it, I think. And, you know, there's also, I think the LDS Church wants to be involved in well. And you know, if you have a child or an adult or, you know, that kind of thing that is struggling with mental illness, you know that there's a triage that goes on for these counselors where they're trying to help people, but they can only handle like high crisis cases at the moment, right? Where, you know, and that's that type of preventative management, you know, that's like putting a net off the end of the bridge, you know, sorry if that's a terrible analogy, which is a terrible place. We would much rather treat them before they get to the end of the bridge.
And I just want to also acknowledge that May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and there are so many wonderful programs happening across our community through NAMI, the American Foundation to Prevent Suicide Utah, and many different outlets to get connected to support, but there needs to be more in this state, and this is a good investment.
These, you know, sound to me like silver linings from the COVID pandemic. You know, that is these investments that will make our community better. They've also got $35 million of that $540 million that they appropriated, $35 million to go to improve broadband networks and the security of state computer systems, $100 million to pay for water development conservation programs. Wow. And I'm not even, I've left tens of millions of dollars on the table. And so, Shireen and Dan, just to kind of wrap up this segment before we go to some more kind of controversial items that were talked about in the special session. But Shireen, if you were giving a report card, a grade to legislators on what they did in this special session, where would you give them?
So I'm really heartened to see the additional investments to address hunger. So food security is a part of this. And when we think about things like broadband, especially as we move to greater access to healthcare through telehealth, we think about the impact that's had on communities when kids had to be remote, which may happen more frequently when kids are just sick. There's a huge opportunity to really reinforce the infrastructure around access on many levels. And I think these are good investments. Overall, there are things I would have, you know, preferred to have seen here, but I would give this a passing grade. Pass, fail, I give it a passing.
Dan, I don't know if passing is a C or a B. So can I just ask you to clarify that? Is it a C or a B?
Don't look at my report card back in high school, because I would say a D also passes.
I'm giving this one a solid C. C plus.
Oh my goodness. You know, Shireen, this is where we're going to be different. I'm going to give a solid A to the governor and the legislature for, you know, investing in legacy items, investing in things that are needs, and not spending at all before they have full information. So putting some aside, I think this is a really nice balancing act. So I'm going to go for the A, Dan.
Well, I'm not going to grade us. I'm just going to say, you know, this has been a great, interesting one-time huge cash infusion, and it's going to be interesting to see what we do with the rest, you know, the remaining $1.1 billion.
So the other item, this is the one that gets more controversial, and I think our listeners know where I'm going, but the governor issued the call on Monday for the special session. He declined to place two bills on the special session call or agenda. One bill sought to ban critical race theory in K through 12 education, and the other one would create a Second Amendment sanctuary state. You know, a day or so later, Senate Republicans and the House both put up resolutions calling themselves into special session to address those two issues. Dan, tell us what happened.
Well, you know, the governor always has a lot of leverage when it comes to special sessions and what gets on there and what doesn't. And if you are able to make the governor feel at peace with the policy and the direction it's going to go, then, you know, it's likely you're going to get your item on there. And if you can't, then it's unlikely to make it on the call, right? And I think, in my opinion, I think the governor probably did the right thing in saying, look, this is going to be an item on both of those issues. This is going to be something that's going to take a little bit of time, and maybe we should spend a little time, you know, focused on the policy and, you know, getting those measurements right. Measure twice, cut once. That's always a governor's speech. And the legislature is like ready, fire, aim, you know, at times. And so, you know, if I'm critical of our own process, I'd say that's one of my complaints. And so that said, you know, I think there's going to be plenty of time to try and work together to get these things right.
Shireen, what did you see in all of this drama?
Oh, so, you know, ultimately, I was reminded of a quote from Macbeth, and that these seem to be items full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. We're talking about issues that really don't seem like they're well understood. The Second Amendment one, I think, is a different issue, but the debate that would happen on critical race theory today in our legislature suggests to me that there were a number of individuals simply out of their depth without a clear understanding of what this was. Mm-hmm. And resolutions ultimately, you know, send a message, but in terms of tactical policy, do very little. I think that this was a disservice to the use of time in our legislature. I do think it was rushed to be put on the agenda in this way that feels really disingenuous without really consulting experts or bringing in diverse voices or even consulting Democrats in elected office in our state legislature. So I'm not proud of what I saw happen today. I hope that there is an opportunity to get this right. When we're talking about something like starting to get in the territory of talking about ideas that shouldn't be taught, theories that shouldn't be taught, I question really if that's the role of our state government, and I'm disappointed that that's the conversation that seemed to be happening today.
Mm-hmm. Dan and Shireen, we got a break before the next segment, but I'll just say from the political middle, there was some artful policy making here, because the governor sent a message by not putting it on the call. The legislature sent a message by saying, hey, we're going to pass these resolutions. But in the end, there is going to be a lot more discussion. And there's going to be, I think, a good middle way found.
Can I tell you what I think the big loser in this whole process is, right? You know, Twitter or whatever, everybody thinks the legislature's stupid. How dare they do this? Blah, blah, blah. They don't have insights into our inbox, so they don't know, you know, all the complaints or concerns or that kind of thing. Look, the big problem is that if you go and read the resolution, it just says in very simple terms, like, don't treat race as a category on which to, you know, train a curriculum, or and don't treat people of different races in different ways in schools. That's a very unifying message. And it's a message that of like, you know, encouragement and direction for the state board to study and analyze that. That's fine. Right. And my problem with the Democrats being against the motion or against the resolution is it just feeds into those concerns that, you know, rational or irrational, whatever people want to say about, you know, people being irrational about critical race theory. The problem is, by being against those things, you're highlighting the concerns and in some ways saying, you know what, we really want to make race and the ability to make decisions based on race to be a key component of our curriculum. And I'll tell you, when you look at like 70% of America, and that is white, black, red, brown, it doesn't matter. Most people in America do not want schools to be like programming one way or the other on race theory. It just, that isn't what the role, and polling consistently showed that.
Shireen, we'll give you the last word.
So that was a that was an incredible just like flipping of the narrative, Dan. I have to hand it to you on that.
Thank you.
But I will say it specifically says identifies risks of critical race theory, which is not currently in curriculum in Utah. Now, that alone, when it's impossible for the people who are bringing this to the floor to define what they are referencing, we have a problem, and the process is not healthy.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm with Shireen Gourbani and Dan McCam, Natalie Gochner. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the political center. We're on Both Sides of the Aisle. We've been talking about the special session, but I want to flip now, Shireen and Dan, and I want to talk about the minimum wage. And the reason it's in the news is we've got Senator Romney once again doing his thing where he's sort of reaching across the aisle. He's working with an Arizona Democrat, Kyrsten Sinema, and they're talking about a bipartisan minimum wage plan. They're not using a number yet, at least that I've heard, but it, you know, conceptually, the national minimum wage right now is $7.25 an hour. Some states vary there. In Utah, we stay at $7.25 an hour. But it looks like Romney's willing to raise it. And my guess is, Shireen, that he is playing defense to try and not have a $15 one go into effect nationwide.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see what number they actually come forward with. And I think a couple things here are of interest. One is that the reason that Utah, no city in Utah has a higher minimum wage is because the state legislature has said that there will be no municipality that has a higher minimum wage than the federal minimum wage. So this is another great opportunity to highlight when the state says, you know, cities can't do things. And at the same time, talking about how much we love local control here. But one of the things that caught my attention was an article in the Trib today. I don't know, Natalie, if you had a chance to see this, that was suggesting that part of what's driving our housing crisis is low wages, the low wages that we have in Utah. I'm wondering what your reaction is to that or what you thought about that.
You know, this was an analyst from the Department of Workforce Services. I think his analysis is off base from my way of thinking, you know, because I should be careful because I didn't hear the full expression. But what was reported is that it's not a supply problem. And it's absolutely a supply problem. We have a housing shortage. We need more units built quickly. And the notion that we could solve our housing problem by artificially paying people more than the market demands, that doesn't compute for me. So
I think it's part of, I thought it was interesting. I do think it's part of the mix. And I hear a lot from people who are really concerned that we're seeing a lot of people coming in out of state and scooping up homes with cash. That's certainly a concern, but I think from my experience, especially sitting on the county council, I do think supply and demand is the bigger issue here.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. And the other thing, we can get back to minimum wage specifically, but our incomes in Utah are high. Our household income is relatively high. It's because of our large household sizes and more income earners per household, but we buy housing on a household basis. And so I don't see it the same way that this analyst did. Dan, on the minimum wage, I saw a tweet from you. I don't follow Twitter religiously, but when you tweet, I sometimes see things. And you tweeted something that I know to be true. And I think it was something like that less than 3% of all wage and salary workers receive the minimum wage. It matches my data exactly. I think that's what you tweeted. And most are 25 years old or younger. And a third of them are waiters and waitresses. Now, this is older data that I'm quoting here. But the point is that our prevailing wage is much higher right now than the minimum wage.
Yeah. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you know, is where I pulled my data from. And I only know that because when I was quoting from your articles and your data set, it just quoted to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So, of course, Natalie, we agree. I would just say that there is a lot to be understood and misunderstood, honestly, about a minimum wage and its economic impact, about how things are. I get from a placebo standpoint, if there are people still making, you know, $6 or $7.25 an hour, you know, clearly I can see where that's a problem. But, you know, we're still talking about almost 50% of the population. It's under the age of 24. These are college jobs for the most part. And then, you know, towards the end of our lives, people tend to pick up a last job to fill in a few minutes here and there of their lives and keep them busy, that kind of thing. And I've talked to a couple of folks that do that. I just say, let the market, and that's just totally surprising for everybody here on this call and listening to, you know, listening to us, let the market deal with the wage problems. It is. I have two teenagers in my house right now who legitimately were at work the other day and had another company come in, and because they were friendly and nice, invite them to potentially apply over at this other place that was making $1 an hour more. This is the environment that, is going on right now with this bidding. And my kids, I mean, a kid making $13 an hour, that's crazy.
Shireen, your comments on the minimum wage.
I would like people, working people, to be able to make ends meet in this country. And I think that there are far too few people who are able to do that.
Yeah, yeah. My concern, Shireen, is sometimes there's unintended consequences, right? You raise the minimum wage and people replace labor with technology, and then you hurt the very people you're trying to help. And I also have a problem with, you know, treating Salt Lake City labor market the same as, you know, San Francisco or New York or whatever. And or so Canada. I like a lot of variation and local. Mm-hmm. And I think markets do it best, but my guess is what Romney's doing is he's going to look for local flexibility and a higher minimum wage, but not going all the way to the 15.
I'd like to see us go to the 15, but I actually think that having flexibility at the local level is also important.
Dan, I was with the Speaker of the House yesterday, and I said to him, Speaker Wilson, this change in per pupil funding, so Utah's no longer dead last on the list of per pupils funding, I said, this happened under your watch. You should take pride in that. And he just kind of, you know, shook me off, because we went from 51st to 50th because D.C.'s in the ranking. But honestly, it's been over 2 decades. And so I think it's a big deal. And this is 2019 data, so it doesn't even include all of the advancements that were made in 2020 when Utah, relative to other states, has done really well. So, Dan, props to you.
Hey, we're good for now. You know, give us a couple of years and I'm sure Idaho will fall its way back down the list or find some new money. And there we go.
Shireen, I remember working with a new school board superintendent. This is when I was at the Salt Lake Chamber, but he was making his pitch to me that our low per pupil funding just showed how efficient we are. And I just kind of looked at him. I said, you know, I'm not sure if I'd make that argument. we should be investing in our kids.
Yeah, I would like to see that. What is concerning to me is to see that this is really the longest that anyone has held that bottom position for over, I think, is it almost 20 years? What that is going to mean to a generation of students is concerning to me, and I think should be concerning to all of us, especially as we see just more and more competitive workforce demands in this state and in this country.
Go ahead, Dan, if you had another one.
Yeah. I was just going to say, Natalie, this goes to, you know, kind of what you talked about before. One of the biggest issues we face is that our birth rate has been so much higher than the rest of the nation. So when you compare per pupil funding and look at our birth rate, it's super hard to manage, you know, high birth rate and the alternative. But I guess what what many will be super excited about, although it is a big problem from an economic factor, is that our fertility rates are dropping as a state. And as a result of losing fertility rate, we are going to see an increase in our per pupil funding. And so congratulations, I guess. It just feels weird to measure our education expenditures based on incomes rather than outcomes. But who am I, right?
We only have a couple more minutes left in the program. Evan McMullen is making the news again. He has joined with 150 other conservatives to threaten Dan to leave the GOP unless there's reform. I think they're calling it the rebirth of the American cause. But interestingly, he's got former governors, former House members, former senators. He's got Kellyanne Conway's husband, George Conway, and even the White House former Trump communications director for a few days anyway, Anthony Scaramucci. What do you make of what McMullen's doing? And then we'll ask Shireen to comment.
So I'm not going to say his name, because at the end of the day, I just think he is a complete sideshow. And sadly, people become affected or disaffected with their party. Fine, go your direction. Enjoy it. And we'll let you find another opportunity.
Shireen.
I hope that opportunity is in representing Utahns in office. I think that he brings an interesting perspective that is much more rooted in conservatism, that is much more tied to principles and values than some of the sideshow that I think we're seeing in the Republican Party today. And I think that could be healthy. In the last second, I just want to pitch that if you haven't read Natalie Gochner's piece, Here's Why Data and Dialogue Are the Key to Improving Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, that was in the Deseret News, you should go read it. I think we should have more data-based and dialogue-driven discussions around those issues. And it's a great piece.
Yeah, you're nice. Thanks, Shireen. And I'll just say on the Evan McMullen thing, keep an eye on him, but I think there's other ways to make progress here within the party. And I'm just reminded that when Watergate happened, people thought the Republican Party was just dead and rival, and Reagan happened a few years later. You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner. I've been joined by Shireen Gorbani and Senator Dan McKay. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody.